no knowledge that the financial statements of HealthSouth overstated the financial condition of HealthSouth at the time of the buyback. The second proposition is it was adhered to or agreed to in the telephone conference with Judge Strine that the accounting fraud issues would not be part of this litigation and that they would be assumed in favor of Mr. Scrushy. That's at page appendix 744 of the telephone conference. The Chancery Court nevertheless reached a summary judgment based on two theories. First, on just enrichment, secondly, innocent misrepresentation. But in doing so, it predicated its liabilities on one single factual determination. That is, that Mr. Scrushy failed to properly supervise the subordinates that committed a fraud on behalf of the company. That determination directly implicated Caremark, but instead of applying the Caremark standard, the court ignored that test and even went so far to suggest, I would say, strict liability. Plaintiffs alleged in this case that Mr. Scrushy had a duty, or Mr. Scrushy, had he acted as a diligent CEO, would have somehow discovered this problem. That's in their opening brief on for summary judgment, page 21. In the penultimate conclusion, Judge Strine decided that whether by virtue of conscious wrongdoing, negligent oversight of his subordinates, or innocent failure to catch the misdeeds or inaccuracies of his underlings, Mr. Scrushy allowed these financial statements to be prepared, and he signed them. If you read Judge Strine's decision, there's multiple findings throughout that supports that conclusion. But there's no evidence in this record that any such analysis was undertaken or to support the conclusions that he somehow failed in this duty of supervision over those subordinates. For those reasons, we submit that the Chancery Court should be reversed, and this court has plenary review to look at those decisions. Now, why do I say this is a Caremark case? If you step back and look at this case in its broad light, it is, in essence, what a person ought to have known. The plaintiff's pleadings say that, the summary judgment motions say that, and the decision says that. They pled it that way, the court found it that way, and that is the way this case is brought to this court at this time. So what does Caremark require? Caremark, which flows out of Graham, says that in the absence of any suspicion, and again, I've emphasized that because the assumption here is that he had no knowledge, but in the absence of suspicion, there is no duty to install any system of corporate espionage to ferret out the wrongdoing of the employees. Caremark's language, in the absence of grounds to suspect deception, neither the corporate board nor senior officers can be charged with wrongdoing simply for assuming the integrity of their employees or the honesty of their dealings. Although Caremark dealt with directors, Graham dealt with senior officers, and Judge Strine in Gutman versus Wang himself decided that the Caremark standard and that test applies to officers. What else does Caremark require? It requires the showing of a sustained and systematic failure to exercise oversight sufficient to demonstrate a lack of good faith as a necessary condition of liability. There is no evidence in this record there has been any such sustained or systematic failure to exercise oversight. In fact, the only proceeding where there has been any evidence of that type adduced is an SEC asset hearing before Judge Johnson, the federal judge in Alabama, to decide the SEC case. And what did she hold? And we attached that to our papers. She said, far from there not being internal controls, compliance programs, Mr. Scrushy was the key proponent of setting up those systems. Granted, she acknowledged that internal controls cannot be so specific that you catch the mythical pink elephant. But the point is, the HealthSouth was a defendant in that case, just as they are the party to this case. We're not saying it's collateral estoppel, but we're saying that those findings and that type of analysis should be brought to bear in these proceedings and that a hearing should be held to develop those types of factual matters. The third thing that I point about Caremark, it said that regardless of the magnitude or the scale of the problem, that in and of itself is not a basis to draw the inference that someone has failed to carry out their duties. Based on Caremark and Graham, the Chancery Court should have reached the same conclusions here. As in Caremark, there's not been any showing of willful or intentional violations of the law. In fact, we have to assume, page 878, Mr. Scrushy knew nothing. As in Caremark, we have the absence of an adversarial process, we have the absence of a discovery record, so there's no evidence on which to make the determination that he breached any duty to supervise or failure to watch what his subordinates were doing or that he ought to have known what was going on within the company. I'll just point out as an aside, if you look back at paragraph 13 of the plaintiff's amended complaint, they say, contrary to what the vice chancellor decided, that Owens, the president and COO at the time of the buyback, is the person who is in the best position to know what was going on in this company. Somehow, the vice chancellor and this record has appeared before this court or come to this court, that vice chancellor decision says Mr. Scrushy was in the best position. We've assumed that he knows nothing, and the plaintiff's own pleading said Mr. Owens was in the best position to know this. How did we get to the point without any type of analysis or any factual record that Mr. Scrushy was in the position to know? The second legal question this court has to address is the issue of imputation. There were 15 officers and employees of HealthSouth, including all five of the CFOs, who have acknowledged responsibility for the preparation of these false financial statements, who have admitted that they falsified these financial statements for the benefit of the company. The problem that we asked this court review the vice chancellor's decision is that there is no analysis of the imputation and what's called the adverse interest exception. The adverse interest exception basically says that if a person is doing something for their own benefit, as opposed to the benefit of the corporation, you have an exception to the imputation rule. We point the court to Senko, in which Judge Posner in the Seventh Circuit clearly distinguishes those two aspects of it. In this case, these officers falsified these financial statements for the benefit of HealthSouth. Step back and ask yourself, what was the intent of the officers at the time that they did this for the financial statement? Were they doing it for their own benefit? Is this like embezzling from a corporation, or is this for the benefit of HealthSouth? In our view, it's clearly for the benefit of HealthSouth. That's why they were doing it. In that context, the adverse interest exception does not apply, and you must impute the guilt to the corporation. We submit that that type of analysis was not conducted. We'd ask this court to undertake such analysis. Now, if you agree with us, which I hope you must, that imputation is required, what flows from that? There are two or possibly three results. Number one, there can be no finding of justifiable reliance, which is an element of the plaintiff's claim for innocent misrepresentation or equitable fraud. The second is that Mr. Scrushy is entitled to avail himself of the privileges or the defenses of in per delicto and unclean hands. With respect to the former, justifiable reliance as an element of innocent misrepresentation. If you impute the guilty knowledge of those 15 officers, that means that that claim goes away. As a matter of law, the plaintiffs cannot prevail on it. I would just add for the court's insight, if you look at the element of intent to induce, which is also innocent misrepresentation, if you assume that he had no knowledge, and if you assume Mr. Owens, as they claim, was in the best position, how can you arrive at the decision that, and you impute the guilt to the corporation, how can you say that he intended to deduce anything? At most, that's a state of mind requirement. You have to get into his head. There has not been that type of analysis. There are no facts in this record to reach that.
May I interrupt you for a
sure.
second? With respect to the imputation argument, mm-hmm. you're saying that because we're assuming that Mr. Scrushy knew nothing about the falsification or the alleged falsification of the financial statements, and yet there were these other managers and officers who did, who were involved in all that, that means the corporation is the wrongdoer, if you will, and that the corporation therefore can't prevail on a claim. Am I correct in what the theory is, more or less?
More or less, yes.
All right. My question is, why doesn't that wrongdoing, if it's going to be imputed to anyone, be imputed to Scrushy in his capacity as the head of the company?
I would invite the Justice to look at the Senko decision by Judge Posner, in which he started from that proposition. That is, what is the objective here? Whose interests are we trying to protect? And in that case, like this one, it was a financial fraud carried out by the top managers of the corporation. And Judge Posner said, even though it appears as if, in a sense, you're leaving the shareholders as a victim, that in the context of your question, that is still the result that happens as a result of the imputation. Because if the fraud is done for the benefit of the company, that result follows as a matter of law. Now, the other piece that I think is embedded in your question, we're not saying that the shareholders can't sue Mr. Scrushy for something. Sue him for fraud. Sue him for whatever theory you have, but make the showing. Make the evidentiary showing and make the legal arguments you want to make. But in the context of this record, the way it comes before this court, he is assumed to have not known about the falsity of the financial statements. The shareholders can have a remedy. They can pursue the other causes of action that the plaintiffs have laid out in their complaint, and they can pursue it through the proper evidentiary showing and the proper legal constructs. But the way they have chosen to bring this before you, the way they have constructed this appeal, we are here now on the assumption that he did not know about those financial statements.
So whether he knew about them or not, wouldn't you agree that he was enriched beyond what he would have been if the financial statements had been accurate?
With respect to unjust enrichment, when I step back and look at this, I think it's a question of law and a question of fact. If you say someone is unjustly enriched and entitled to, therefore, the plaintiff's title restitution, I think you have to make a determination that someone violated some type of duty. But what I mean by that is, if you read as Schock versus Nash puts unjust enrichment and restitution together in the same thought, there has to be a fine by conscionability. And if you look at the cases from this court and other courts, what do they look at for unconscionability? They look at legal principles that operated in that relationship, and they look at the factual determinations. What are the legal principles operating here? What are the duties that this officer had? Did he fulfill those duties? Under Caremark, we submit he did fulfill those duties. On the factual side of unconscionability, what benefit has he received versus the benefit the corporation received? It's almost like a balancing of the equities, if you will. The corporation clearly said they had three discrete benefits, and that's cited in the Horton email, one of which was to further the buyback, the repurchase program that they had at the company. As far as Mr. Scrushy's benefit, what did he end up with? If you look at Judge Johnson's decision, we established in that case, for $8 million that he paid, including 3 years of interest of $1 million, he ended up with stock worth $180,000. Is that unjust enrichment? $8 million expense for $180,000 of stock? So if you work your way through the elements of unjust enrichment and what's required for restitution, where is the unconscionability here? Look at the cases that the plaintiffs cite and the cases we've cited. You're looking at a violation of some duty, or you're looking at a factual determination of unconscionability of benefit. If you go through that analysis, I think you'll agree with me at the end of the day that he has not been unjustly enriched. Or put the parties back where they were. Give him all of his stock back so we go back to square one. But not this, where we come before you and they ask for a judgment of $24 million. After he's already paid $8 million, and what is he going to get in return? Nothing. No stock. That's not unjust enrichment in my mind. Let me just quickly, with the time I have remaining, turn to some of the factual issues that I find problematical. If you read the plaintiff's complaint, the core fact that underlies their cause of action is that the CMS, what's called CMS Transmittal 1753, where the Medicare changed the group rate policy. And you look at Judge Johnson's decision, where all of this is laid out, the corporation did not know until August 15, 2 weeks after the buyback, that it applied to the company and that they had to make a determination of materiality. If you read the record of what took place in May, June, July, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alabama in June told them it didn't apply. If you look at the confused guidance the company was getting until they finally went to Washington, D.C. 2 weeks after the buyback, and they said, yes, you fall within the Part B, Part A providers, and this will apply to you. The August 27th press release that gets so much attention here, what does it say? It says, on a forward-looking basis, we anticipate that our EBITDA, our earnings before interest and taxes, could potentially be reduced by $175 million because of this change. It doesn't say that the financial statements were false back before the buyback. It says, going forward, we're going to have a reduction in revenue stream.
One more question, if
sure.
You will. You said that it would be fair, at least, if Scrushy got his shares back. Page 25 seems to suggest that he will get his shares back.
Well, unfortunately, that's not where we are, where we've progressed in this case. We are at a final judgment stage that has turned into money judgment. Now, as I read my time, I have 1:40 left.
Well, that's correct.
I will sit down and respond to the counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning again, Your Honors.
Good morning.
The judgment appealed from does implement the rescission in which Mr. Scrushy does get his shares back. So with respect to my adversary, I really don't understand why this judgment doesn't satisfy what he just indicated he's looking for.
I think the record reflects that if he pays the judgment, then he'll get the shares. Is that correct?
The two are simultaneous in the judgment. The two contemplated a closing on January 2nd, at which Mr. Scrushy would have paid the money and simultaneously received the shares back. It also gives him an option to offset as a credit the value of the shares. And the shares were valued as of the date, I believe, of the opinion. Mr. Scrushy did not, on January 2nd, attend that closing, pay the money, but what he instead did was bring the motion to alter or amend that Judge Shrine dealt with so forcefully subsequent to that. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
Well, I think it indicates that my understanding of the record is accurate.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I want to spend a moment on the question because my adversaries dealt with it in his briefs of who induced the buyback, whose idea was it to pay off these loans with shares. It's very clearly on this record it was Mr. Scrushy's idea. Mr. Horton's email, the general counsel's email, says so, that Richard Scrushy paid the accrued interest and asked to discharge the principal amount of the loan by transferring shares with a value equal to the principal amount. That's at 1191 of the appendix. The Fulbright and Jaworski report, which goes into some detail on all this, in which Mr. Scrushy separately in this record said that he agreed with factually, says the same thing at 095, that he presented to the committee's consideration request by Mr. Scrushy to repay the principal amount. The same report indicates that he thought up the mechanism for valuing the shares, the midpoint between the high and low price on a given date. Mr. Scrushy actually wanted to backdate it to get the benefit of a higher price that actually was the price 30 days before the buyback. So there's no question that the idea of the buyback was Mr. Scrushy's idea. He induced it. And I raise that now for several reasons, and one of them is that it does relate to the inducement element of unjust enrichment. I want to take a moment and address a question that hasn't been addressed here, but was addressed extensively in the briefs, and that is the materiality of the falsity of the financial statements. I noticed that in the reply brief at page 14, for the first time, Mr. Scrushy now admits that there was a financial fraud at HealthSouth, and the financial statements were fraudulently exaggerated. The financial health of the company was exaggerated in the financial statements. And he says, Mr. Scrushy says in his briefs, that all he's challenging now is the materiality. Well, the March press release, the March 3rd, 2003 press release, which Mr. Scrushy is quoted in, was issued when Mr. Scrushy was CEO of the company, and it's plainly under 801D2, an admission by a party opponent and therefore admissible in evidence. Quoted Mr. Scrushy as saying that there were $175 million in cash charges that were not recognized in the previous financial statements. That means that cash was half of what they had said it was in the most recent previous financial statements. A reduction by half of the cash certainly is a fact that one would want to know in deciding whether or not to buy the stock. It gets worse. $65 million in periods in years that ended before the buyback, that ended December 31, 2001, and previous years. Surely, this is something that someone would have wanted to know. $100 million of the write-downs, and these are not just restructuring charges. These are unusual charges in addition to $445 million in restructuring charges. Surely something someone would have wanted to know in the total mix of the information available to him in deciding whether or not to buy the stock. Whether that someone is a private investor or whether it's the compensation committee deciding whether to accept shares in exchange for discharge of a $25 million loan. The total charges in Mr. Scrushy's press release, again, an admission by an adverse party, equaled one half of the tangible net worth of the company. Tangible net worth meaning total shareholders' equity minus goodwill and other intangibles. Tangible net worth as of the most recent year end, the most recent audited financials, was less than $1 billion. It was $972 million. The total write-downs were about 65% of that. How could this not be material to someone deciding whether or not to buy the stock based on these financials? Similarly, in July 2003, after Mr. Scrushy was fired, and PricewaterhouseCoopers came in, did a forensic audit, the presentation they made to stakeholders and reported on an 8K. They reported to the Securities and Exchange Commission that there were $2 billion in fraudulent entries, $2 billion with more to come. Now, this is dramatically against the company's interest and therefore is admissible in evidence under DRE 804B3. So there's no question that plaintiff supported its motion with to the extent that the inaccuracies were material. Finally, going back to the announcement made just 27 days after the buyback, and on August 27th that Mr. Schoenblum referred to, it wasn't just a question of going forward. The CMS report, the Medicare pronouncement, was made on May 17th and was effective July 1. $175 million going forward in effect on pre-tax profits. Now, that is about 40% of the previous year's pre-tax profits. Again, plainly material. I want to address for a minute this idea that somehow a Caremark doctrine rules this case. Caremark is really a shorthand for a type of claim for breach of fiduciary duty. We are not basing our theories, did not then, do not now, nor did Vice Chancellor Strine base his opinion on a breach of fiduciary duty theory. The theories of our case are unjust enrichment and innocent misrepresentation. Neither one of these requires guilty knowledge. The premise of our motion is that Mr. Scrushy somehow didn't know that the five CFOs that ever served under him over 18 years were falsifying the financial statements. But our adversaries do not cite one case that distinguishes unjust enrichment, to take unjust enrichment first. Not one case that distinguishes it, that says it doesn't apply, that undercuts that theory of the case. Unjust enrichment is defined as a benefit, as the unjust retention of a benefit to the loss of another, or the retention of money or property belonging to another against the fundamental principles of justice or equity and good conscience. Our burden was to show that defendants were unjustly enriched. He received $25 million and as a loan, and he discharged that loan by paying with false coin, by paying with putatively gold coin that turned out to be gold-plated tin. The defendants were unjustly enriched, and defendants secured a benefit that would be unconscionable to retain that benefit. Now, Mr. Schoenblum very skillfully equates unconscionability with culpability. That's not the test. The test for unjust enrichment is whether it is unconscionable to retain the benefit, albeit that you might have received it innocently to begin with. And, of course, that's the premise of our motion. There are the cases we cite in are instances where there was no culpability.
Now, in response to your equitable claims, they've asserted equitable defenses. Are you going to address those in your argument?
Yes, I will, Your Honor. I'll do that right now. Imputation is a premise that they have to climb over before asserting either in pari delicto or unclean hands. And by the way, those two doctrines, for all purposes here, are identical. One is an equitable maxim and the other is a legal maxim. In fact, in their papers below, they say the two are identical. So I'll deal with them together. In both cases, the Court of Chancery has a great deal of discretion in deciding whether or not to apply these maxims. And they're maxims that are applied or not applied based on various public policies. If you do not impute to the corporation the knowledge of these of Owens and the others who did plead guilty, if you don't impute that to the corporation, then the twin defenses never leave the tarmac. They just don't get going. If you do impute them, they still have to establish that it's good policy to apply these defenses in this case. Imputation doesn't apply because the cases we cite indicate that if the wrongdoer has a motive for withholding something from the corporation, withholding the information from the corporation, then the adverse interest exception applies. Adverse interest exception is the law everywhere. In this case, not only did they have a motive to withhold it, Mr. Scrushy says they withheld it. He says he didn't know about the financial fraud. Secondly, the Chenko distinction between wrongdoing that harms the corporation and wrongdoing that harms third parties, under no theory of this case does this wrongdoing help the company or turn it into an engine of theft against somebody else. Clearly it was harming the company. Moving on, though, there is no case that's ever been cited in this matter, and we've never found one, in which either unclean hands or an impari delicto is asserted, or may be asserted, as a defense successfully, where a company, derivatively or through a receiver or whatever, is seeking to recover from its own insider. Now, there is no such case. Walnut that we cite, Granite that we cite, clearly distinguishes between the cases. Senko is an example where you try to assert the defense when the person being sued is an accounting firm or something of the like, but never when it is asserted against an insider. Next. The wrongdoing has to be, in order for the defenses to have any force, the wrongdoing has to be committed in connection with the activity on the challenge. In this case, none of the fraud was committed in terms of the buyback. There was no inequitable conduct by the corporation in allowing Scrushy to transfer shares to discharge his loan. The financial fraud began many years earlier. The record is clear on that. The financial fraud began long before the buyback, and the compensation committee members, whoever who negotiated the buyback, let me put it another way. The buyback enriched Scrushy and impoverished the company, so there was clearly no wrongdoing by the company in connection with the buyback. I think it's very important to bear a few things in mind in this case. The Court of Chancery very clearly gave Mr. Scrushy the opportunity to submit a Rule 56F affidavit, not just affidavit, submission. If you look at the order, it's in our appendix B. The order very clearly says that if you want to challenge any facts or put any facts in issue, and you need any discovery to do so, make a submission. Mr. Scrushy very clearly wrote to the court and said, you know what, we're not going to make any submission. We're going to deal with the legal, essentially saying, we're going to deal with the legal consequences of this and not challenge it factually. Well, plaintiff has supported his motion. That's very clear. It supported its motion based on the theories we've asserted, not the theories they wish we asserted, the theories of unjust enrichment and innocent misrepresentation. If Mr. Scrushy was going to argue against that, he had an obligation to either make his own substantive affidavit through counsel or through himself, doesn't matter, or make a submission under Rule 56F. He didn't do that. Finally, I want to come back to the remedy applied because it's so sensible in this context. Mr. Scrushy can argue all he likes about what the price would have been and what it should have been, that it went down to this or went it back up to that. The point is that all of this is subsumed under the very sensible remedy of rescission. There is no new theory of liability. There's no theory of strict liability that this decision, under any reading of it, gives rise to. This is a transaction-specific inducement the company relied on at Mr. Scrushy's request. He wanted to give stock back to repay his loan. They relied on the integrity of the market price when they accepted that stock. Mr. Scrushy had signed the financials long before Sarbanes-Oxley, and therefore there was an implicit representation that the market price was one proxy for the value of those shares that he was giving as coin to repay his loan. There is no new theory of liability. These are very established principles: unjust enrichment, innocent misrepresentation. The parade of horrors, if I may refer to it as that, in the briefs simply do not obtain. This was a CEO, and CEOs have some responsibility to oversee the creation, production, submission of accurate financials, but this is not a fiduciary duty case. This is an unjust enrichment case and an innocent misrepresentation case. And all the rescission does is put the parties back to where they were before the buyback and before the transaction. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Start with his last point and try to work backwards. Has the court imposed a new duty here? Absolutely. If you read Vice Chancellor Strine's decision, he says, merely by virtue of being a CEO, you are the guarantors of the accuracies of the financial statements. That is a new statement of law that we've not seen any place before. Second, Mr. DePrima says this is a transaction-specific holding. We're going to limit it to the four corners of that decision. Before the ink was dry on Vice Chancellor Strine's decision, the plaintiffs filed a likes lawsuit in Alabama asking that the Alabama court treat as collateral estoppel the decision by Vice Chancellor Strine that they now get all of his bonus compensation and all the compensation they've ever made while he's at the company. This is not transaction specific. This is creating a new doctrine that they are trying to use already in other jurisdictions. We have already got beyond the four corners of the Chancery Court. Justice Berger, let me clarify something, because I seem we're getting astray here. In response to your question about whether or not there's been unjust enrichment, I made the comment about putting the shares back. We are not seeking that here. We are asking that this judgment be reversed and it be remanded because of the new law and the absence of facts. Please do not take that off-the-cuff remark as it is asking. We're asking for some kind of modification of judgment. That was not my point.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court appreciates your argument. We'll take this matter under advisement and we'll also take a brief recess.
Please rise.